You are listening to Radio Free Signs of the Times, broadcasting into the heart of an occupied America.
Welcome to this week's Signs of the Time podcast. I'm Henry C.
I'm not Henry C.
I'm not Joe Quinn.
And I'm not Stanley.
With us tonight is special invited guest Stanley B. Stillingfleet, the well-known author who will be publishing a book this year with Red Pill Press, exploring the darker sides of society. The book is entitled, is a working title, In Defense of the Innocent, and it is a detailed look at child pornography, sex slaves, and human trafficking, arms dealing.
The underbelly.
The underbelly of the pathocracy.
The underbelly of government activities.
Yes. This book, I hope, will act as a kind of primer for the shall we say, more difficult material. Or let's not say that. More esoteric material that's available. Children are the platform from which I explore various aspects of society. So that deals with, firstly, human trafficking, sexual slavery, and also narcotics, arms dealing, and how they all link together. And I suppose the fundamental theme that runs throughout is how protection and fear is created to as tools of control, which is very, very similar to the war on terrorism, and it seems to flow throughout society. And society is being used effectively as a scapegoat for various different forms of that control. For example, I've just finished looking or researching child pornography, and on the face of it, if you look at the internet, there's an enormous amount of information about child pornography. Most of it is sensationalist, but laced with an awful lot of truth, which serves the powers that be very well, because if you create an enormous amount of chaos, you put largely innocent people in prison, along with a few paedophiles, for example, or people that are just looking at pornography, which incidentally is not a crime, this serves as a way to displace suspicion towards the people that are really perpetrating this crime, which is people that are protected. And that may be politicians, policemen, members of the judiciary. So there does seem to be a very clever and complex theme that could be discerned, where you effectively make a lot of innocent people scapegoats. But in that, there is still a very strong flavour and suspicion that it doesn't seem to be quite the whole story. I mean, there's been a lot of examples since 1996 with the Marc Dutroux case in Belgium, which is very famous. I think most people have heard of that. He was effectively called a paedophile and a psychopath, but he was a small, if you like, a garden variety psychopath who was clearly used as a way to not only fulfill his own fantasies in that respect, but he was certainly used in a wider network that included quite a few officials within the judiciary, military, the police, who used children for abuse. So Marc Dutroux was put away really as a sop for the media and for people that wanted justice. But of course, the people that were really perpetrating these crimes are still at large, because again, they're protected. So you're getting many, many situations where you have a very high-profile jury that comes to the decision that the minor players are guilty and they're put away. But if you look at a lot of the cases since 1996, and 96 seems to be a pivotal period, there are an enormous amount of cases that seem to be appearing during that year, and many of which, but we don't read this in the media, but many of which turn out to be false claims, or a mixture of the two. And none of the people, bar a few politicians that have been proved innocent, none of the people that that go down have been high profile. Even the ones that have been proved innocent, there's still some aura of suspicion there. And you never really know exactly what's going on, which is why it's such a perfect tool to create fear, total confusion regarding paedophilia and pornography. And this is fundamentally what the book is about. What is really going on, and how is it being used as primarily like the war on terrorism as a way to control? Or is there really a very wide-ranging network of people that prey on children, linked to human trafficking, linked to the underworld, because it's all linked to profit? Or is it just sensationalism? Well, I think, as ever, it's a mixture of all three of those things. And to separate out these elements, a great way to do that is to work back from the war on terrorism and various forms of control that have been debated and discussed on Signs of the Times. So in a very real way, the pornography, child pornography, and human trafficking, and many of the major sources of geopolitical control are primarily about protection, the creation of fear that leads into more and more control.
So are you saying, I mean, on the Science page, we've had a few articles every now and then when they come out with a story and it's, you know, authorities in, you know, 12 countries cracked down and kicked down doors and they arrested, you know, 150 people and they confiscated all these computers with all this, you know, child pornography on it and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I mean, like, what percentage, you know, in these cases are, you know, what percentage of the people are actually innocent, or, you know, do they just plant evidence, you know, just to make examples of people?
Yeah.
or like, how does it, like...
Well, that's the clever thing. It's a mix. It's always a mix. So what we find in some cases, like the Casa Pia orphanage scandal in Portugal, where you did have politicians that were involved, but in the end they've been released after, I think it was a 3 or 4 year case. There was still some suspicion, but the evidence was so poor. It was all on hearsay. It was all from witness testimony. And remember, there's a lot of compensation. There's a lot of money involved in saying you've been abused. That's not to say that people weren't abused. It's a mix of the two. So you're getting people that weren't abused looking for some really decent cash. And you've got politicians that were abusers. But many of the people that are really perpetrating these crimes are not in court. So effectively, it's all sealed up before you even get there. But you have enough of a showcase, enough of a pantomime, to give the public the idea that justice is being done.
Just talking about the, you talk about the people that are really behind this, or really the orchestrators of this, and you've also talked about you mentioned the word, geopolitical control. And at the beginning, you talked about the kind of three areas of child pornography, human trafficking, and drug trafficking. And my question is just, are these activities government-inspired? Do they essentially come down from the level of government, or what percentage? If not, what percentage is from the government, and what percentage is from, for example, the underworld? And is there a difference between the underworld and government? Is there a government underworld?
Yeah, I think there is, but again, it's a highly complex area. But from what I can gather so far, is there was certainly a dedicated campaign. America and England are good examples of this, in that there was a recent high-profile case called Operation Ore, which is apparently a crackdown on child pornography. Well, if you look at the figures and the investigations, and if you look at the newspaper articles, it's very sensationalist. It's very high profile. But now that it's been wound up, I think it was wound up in 2005, the number of people, innocent people, is scores of innocent people that it's now been proven had nothing whatsoever to do with looking at child pornography. And it's a complex case, but the evidence is for anyone, if they want to look on the internet, they can find out very, very clear evidence of people that were put away with the flimsiest of testimony. And the reason for that is, by their own admission, the police set up an entrapment operation, because they were told by members of the US government that this was a serious problem. And it is. It is a problem, but it's not as vast an epidemic as is being made out. So the next question is, why would the US government and elements of the British government want to pursue this sort of media frenzy and exacerbate this idea that there is, you know, at least 250,000 websites dedicated to child pornography, which is completely false?
Well, that brings up another interesting question of why. I mean, it seems to me that the whole phenomenon of child pornography has really come to the fore over the past maybe, you know, 10 years or so. And, you know, we can maybe link that with the internet, and that might be some people might suggest that this is one of the primary causes of the spread of this, as the government might tell us, because it's freely available on the internet. But that, for me, that's doesn't quite make sense, because I would have thought that anybody who has a kind of proclivity towards abuse of children or child pornography, that they wouldn't need to. I mean, it would have been. It's part of their makeup in a way, or it's part of who they are, and the internet wouldn't necessarily have that much of an effect on it, because I'm sure child pornography went on long before the internet existed.
Sure.
And abuse of children has been going on for millennia. So, you know, what is the, in your opinion, what is the cause of the recent kind of appearance?
I think it's to do with the fact that people are generally have more information. And there is a growing awareness of abuse generally, but and there is a steady rise in society of abuse. That's without question. But again, it's not as bad as the newspapers, the internet would make out. It does exist, and it is on the rise. There's no question. But it seems to be being used as so many things. It's being used as a tool of control to create more fear. And again, as I said. It seems to be a small minority of people that are seeking to exacerbate the, if you like, the pathological elements within society that are certainly present, but it's like they're seeing how they can use this to their own ends. Mm. How can we create more fear, more control? In other words, to get a tighter and tighter rein on people's idea of what is going on,
or who they are.
Indeed,
they
are,
that's what it seems to me, that there's a palpable sense over the years, over recent years, where this has been in the news a lot, that this is a problem, and it's, you know, obviously it's quite a shameful problem that had been given to society, particularly in the UK. I mean, that's the one place that I would have been aware of it, that it's that this is being, you know, by the media and by the government programs against it, that it's almost like society and, you know, so every individual in society is being told that, you know, that in a way they're responsible for this, or that they should, you know, that's a collective guilt in a way.
It's a really interesting point, because if you look at the nature of sexuality, we know that it is a major topic, an emotive topic. But when you're talking about, if you put a man in the middle of who's judged to be to have raped a baby, for example, now this happens, this goes on, but it's not as frequent as they say. But let's say this man, who has been labelled a child abuser, of raping a baby, a 3-year-old. Now you present that to a jury, and immediately their reasoning is skewed to think that, well, this guy is standing in front of me. And you have photos and visual images of a child that's been raped. Immediately, your sense of reasoning is distorted, but just because of the emotive nature of the subject. So whether that man is guilty or not, he's already in effect in a kind of witch hunt within that setting. So most of the abuse claims that come up. Sure, there are some that go down, and even the sentencing there, they don't know why the sentencing is so lax for people that are clearly guilty. That's the other element. But the other element, I think, is, I mean, I've got a bit of something I wrote in one chapter, if I can just read it. If you remember in the 1980s and 90s, there was a real harassment of people from social workers, from social welfare, this politically correctness gone crazy. there was this heightened sense that, you know, you mustn't do anything that is construed to be abuse. So there's, I wrote here, is the harassment of innocent citizens, where artists, parents, and individuals take nude pictures of their children under entirely natural and loving circumstances, was turned into something sordid and degrading in the minds of the prosecutors. This resulted in untold trauma for all those targeted under the guise of protection, and these laws give further credence to the looming shadow of a very real police state in the United States. More disturbingly, the matter does not stop there. We might also say that we are now faced with the possibility that government itself, after seeking to stem a largely imaginary tsunami of child porn, became its greatest purveyors and sellers due to factional objectives, the most important being perhaps the protection of an elite who do indeed prey on children and young adults as a way of life, systemized and institutionalized by political expediency and blackmail. And this blackmail is a key to that. Because firstly, if you create situations where you have paedophiles in government, then instantly you have a bargaining chip. You're able, and this is from the Israeli perspective, they have a sexpionage unit precisely for that. And a lot of the scandals, Bill Clinton scandals, the Chandra Levy, Monica Lewinsky, all that is directly related to this.
Well, all of that would seem to be just the tip of the iceberg.
Exactly. I mean,
because we suspect that the agents of the State of Israel have been able to gain pretty much a complete control over most of the American executive branch of the government and all of Congress, or most of Congress and Senate, by this type of blackmail, you know, where they're
That's right.
able to infiltrate the lives of these people in various ways it's primarily sexual, or a lot of it is sexual.
Completely.
Obviously, there's other kind of dealings that they can be blackmailed over, but a lot of it would be in terms of, like you're saying, this the demonization of any kind of sexual conduct, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you have people gravitating to that type of system, that pyramidal system in politics, where they seem to have that nature, whether it be abuse or rape or paedophilia, which is essentially about power, I think. So you get people that are interested in power and have this kind of pathology. So they're very useful in that way. And then you've got the society being demonized to see that that everything they do sexually somehow can be reported as some form of abuse. I mean, in some areas you've got some right-wing or conservative people in Britain saying this is the nanny state. And although I wouldn't go along with many of the things that the conservative political conservatism, as it is in Britain at the moment, that particular nanny state is rapidly turning into police state precisely because of this freedom to just take innocent pictures of your child. For goodness sake, you know, is actually you can be prosecuted now.
Well, there have been cases where people at, you know, like one-hour photo places in the U.S. have developed photos of parents who've taken pictures of their children, and they turn them over to the police.
Yeah.
But there are other cases in the United States where, wasn't there one recently, where some six-year-old in a daycare center or in, you know, daycare or you know, kindergarten or something was accused of sexual harassment of one of his playmates.
Mm. Yeah, because he put one of his fingers or something just in the waistband of his classmate's pants.
Mm-hmm. But it's a perfect way to essentially block a natural sexual expression. Not only that, but it's a perfect way to make people super, super sensitive to every aspect in society. And it's a way the beauty of it is so complex. I mean, there's so much truth within all of this, so you can mix it up so that no one really knows what the hell's going on. But the only people that do and are able to continue this because of this protection are the people that are beyond the law.
Yeah. Well, the people who make the laws. people who make the laws.
Exactly.
You mentioned the Dutroux case earlier on. In the media circus that surrounded that, did the mainstream media in Belgium or anywhere else focus at all on who might have been behind Dutroux?
Yeah, not really, no. There was, in fact, the Belgians themselves did a massive demonstration, probably the biggest demonstration related to a crime trial ever. And I forget the name now, but they did wear white flags demanding, you know, justice, because any idiot could see that it wasn't just Dutroux that was the lone.
That there was a network behind him.
Yes, yeah. and that this network was included. Politicians, had yes. Politicians and members of the establishment.
There were members of the judiciary, and the judiciary. There was another judge that was eventually replaced by Konnerup, who was a fantastic judge who had personal dealings with the case. In fact, he was one of the people that were present when two of the girls were rescued. So he had intimate knowledge of the case. Right from the beginning, and he was a very experienced judge. Of course, he was eventually taken off the case from people saying that he had abused his position through this impartial position, because he attended a charity gathering related to this. So that was this was said that this was not on. So he was taken off, and he was saying that he was intimidated by what he called a virtual mafia.
Mm-hmm.
That was operating within Belgian judiciary, and that was intimately involved with this network. He had no qualms about saying that. This was after the trial.
For me, the kind of the frightening thing about the whole situation is that it doesn't. I can accept the fact that there are a group of people who had organized themselves in some kind of a network. And from which they would then prey on children, organise the kidnapping of children to be abused or to be sexually abused. But from all of these cases that have been in the media, which you kind of outline in your book, it's pretty clear that obviously that these kind of networks exist, but that they wield an awful lot of power. That they're able to suppress and control the judiciary. They're able to get away with it, essentially.
Sure.
And that kind of suggests to me that these people are, I don't know, what are the areas of power in our society? It's government and it's big business.
Definitely.
And it's organized. Okay, it's organized crime, but organized crime very often has a link toward government and big business as well.
Sure.
So that's the kind of frightening aspect of it. And I often wonder about, like we've been talking, just which members of Western governments are actually essentially child abusers,
Sure. Well, a high percent. I mean, there's certainly rumours that in the New Labour Party, there's been persistent rumours now that they're. I mean, it's just almost like a joke in some circles that it's a paedophilia party. I mean, you have to be careful with that, because you don't know for sure. And it can so easily.
And it's an easy way to smear your opponents.
Exactly.
As well.
This is why it's so perfect, because it can be. They are winners either way. Mm-hmm.
When you see that some person in power is being accused of pedophilia, and you don't like the guy, it's very easy to want to believe what you're hearing, whether or not it's true.
Yeah. This is what happened in the Casa Pia case in Portugal. There was one guy that really did seem to be completely innocent. It was politically motivated. But then in Italy, there was a case that was with clear evidence. There's unequivocal evidence of the most, appalling crimes where children were tortured to death on video. And this was the Necros Pedos trial that was, just beyond belief. And there was many people that they thought that they didn't get to. They got, once again, small-time handlers that were sort of sacrificed. And again, after the Dutroux case, there was a link to André Coulz in Belgium, who was assassinated in 1991, who was equivalent of, I think it was a social democrat social democratic politician in the Belgian government, who was found to have been assassinated by Mossad, who then had links to Gerald Bull, who was a major arms dealer, and some of the elements, some of the people suspected and who weren't prosecuted had definite links to Gerald Bull and this network of arms dealers, and which André Kools was going to blow the whistle on. So he was taken out by Mossad, which then leads us to the idea of how much does Mossad and Israeli how much does the Israeli influence extend into these fields of espionage and weapons, and I think the answer is they've got their mitts in almost every aspect. I should say that the Zionist aspect is a very, very interesting and complex cesspool.
Well, certainly if you read on the Jewish Tribal Review website their book, where When Victims Rule, they have masses of data.
Oh, incredible.
About Israeli and Jewish involvement in porn, in prostitution, in white slavery.
I don't want to focus in and sort of put the onus on the fact that this is a Jewish thing. It's absolutely not. There's a big difference between being in the pornography business, you know, regardless of its morality, to the systematic practice of child abuse.
Mm.
Now there is a moral argument there in terms of pornography, and that's another issue. But there is, you were talking about the how business, geopolitics and business are linked, and you can really see that link that capitalist, extreme capitalism that's manifesting in Iraq, for example, and in Africa, and most of the reason for that is due to European and American corporations essentially raping these countries. I mean, that's an emotive word, but that's what it is. Because you get news reports of tribalism saying that, you know, the children have been raped and people, you know, whole villages destroyed. And if you look at the reasons why this tribalism is occurring, you can trace it back to corporations in the recently established African Union, for example, which is all about creating these unions to serve essentially Western imperialism. I mean, it's kind of an old leftist word, but it's very, very much applicable. And I've got a little quote here from an article by Jan Goodman from The Nation. She's a humanitarian worker, and she was talking about the Democratic Republic of Congo, and she talks about rape as a weapon. I mean, this has long been known. Organized rape can be used as a weapon to destroy families, to make sure that none of the children can join the other side, if you like, and it destroys the family line. So she talks about this. So she says, meanwhile, a UN Security Council panel has cited 85 multinational corporations, including some of the largest US companies in their fields, for their involvement in the illegal exploitation of natural resources from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The commerce in these blood minerals, such as coltan, used in cell phones and laptops, cobalt, copper, gold, diamonds and uranium. Congolese uranium was used in the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is what drives the conflict. The brutality of the militias, the sexual slavery, transmissions of HIV, AIDS, through rape, cannibalism, slaughter and starvation, forced recruitment of child soldiers has routinely been employed to secure access to mining sites or ensure a supply of captive labour. So this is a corporate policy, unspoken, but this is what goes on as a matter of course in Africa and to a certain extent in the Balkans. And that's another story. So it's a familiar formula where this tripartite structure of arms, trafficking and narcotics feed each other. And human trafficking certainly is probably, in another 10 years, if we have that long, it's going to eclipse narcotics as the major funding. It's a if it's a throwaway society, a consumerist society, you're literally consuming and throwing away children to support this triangle, this structure.
Well, there's a question that I think each of us have that we've talked about. You're looking at, as Joe said earlier, the underbelly of things, and you're really looking into the cesspool. How do you do it and stay sane?
I don't. Well, for me, the way to cope with what you see is to feel like you're doing something without any kind of anticipation, but just allowing all that energy, that effectively blocked energy, to be released constructively. I mean, it's if you think that you're all these things you see is not something you want to be part of, and it's something that you very deeply is not part of your life. It's not something you want to promote. It's not something that's
part
of who you are. Then the only way that you can release that energy productively, creatively, is by applying that knowledge of what you see
to fight against it.
To defend against it.
To defend the innocent.
Indeed.
In defense of the innocent. And that is the title of Stanley's book that we've been discussing this week on the Signs of the Times podcast. It'll be available sometime this year, and all of our listeners will be able to find details about that book on our website at www.signs-of-the-times.org.
We'd like to thank Stanley for taking time out of his busy research schedule to come and visit us tonight. And hopefully when your book is closer to being published, we'll be able to have you back.
It would be a very great pleasure, Henry.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.